Queen of Philippine, which is briefly called Queenstown Maiden. I have sitting with me in this here in this room, on my left, Commissioner Crawford from Auckland, and on my right, Commissioner Mountford from Christchurch. I think for the first time we have all claimants on the hearing panel. I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing. Now, Ms. Scott.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Commissioner. Just as a housekeeping to start with, just to make sure we remember what we've got in front of us. So, I understand we've got 4.5 days to work through the council's case. On Friday, I did file a memorandum setting out how we propose to provide and present the council's evidence. Essentially today it will be my legal submissions and then just put up the evidence which will be presented in a normal way by Ms. Banks, which is a strategic overview and growing capacity. And then we will hear from Mr. Osborne and finally Mr. Grasner. On the previous list there are four witnesses where the panel confirmed on Friday that it had no questions for them. So we have taken the panel up on this offer and we might be flying them or bringing them to Queenstown. But I have still asked them to table a summary of the evidence that had already been prepared. So they are in front of you and I will just sort of refer you to them at the appropriate time. So that is Mr. Clark, who was down for today, will not be appearing. Tomorrow morning, Mr. Charlie Watts, he will not be appearing. Mr. Calvin Lloyd, his evidence was focused on ecology matters for one rezoning, submission 361. He will not be appearing. And then finally, Dr. Charles, whose evidence was specific to the extension of Jack's Point. And we have, I think we'll work with the same witnesses for the council. Two of those you will not be hearing from this week, that is Mr. Timothy Heath and Ms. Helen Nalsop, and we will be, they will be appearing on Monday, 4th of September. They are both overseas this week. Also filed has been a bundle of documents that have been filed over a period of time, over the last three hearings, but there is a council bundle, a supplementary bundle, and a second supplementary bundle. But in the council's evidence, you would have seen CB in a number, so that is, of course, a reference to the council's bundle. In terms of the case law that is referred to in my legal submission, we have filed a case book. We have filed case books in various hearings, and all of the cases that are referred to have been already been provided in the case book. So I haven't handed up more paper, but I can perhaps get a link to the Upper Clutha reply case book, which basically includes all of the cases that I referred to this morning to you, so that you can have an electronic copy. I think the majority of them are, otherwise they'll be in the strategic case book right back from hearing stream one. So perhaps we could just get the relevant links and get them forward to you on one email.
Yes.
Thank you. And finally, you have the legal submissions in front of you and a copy of all of the evidence summaries. I understand, except for Ms. Nalsop, who managed to get overseas with funneling. But that will be filed in advance of her appearing on 4th of September. So, unless you have any questions to start with, I will get started on the written legal submission.
Yes.
There are a couple of typos I have picked up, but I propose to correct them as I go. So as you will be aware from your site visits and revenue evidence, the council has split the Queenstown rezoning submissions into 5 geographic sub areas and therefore are addressed by different planners, which are listed there on the table on page 1. I also draw your attention to the strategic overview and common themes evidence of Ms. Kimberly Banks. As this provides a strategic overview of the recommendations to the panel and addresses a number of common themes, and Ms. Banks will be the first witness at your call this morning. Her evidence also draws together the evidence that the council has presented in earlier hearing streams on the council's strategic chapter. And the underlying approach taken in the key zones at issue, for example, the rural zone and various residential zones. So the purpose of that is to give you as much insight into the council strategic approach as possible, particularly for Commissioner Crawford and Commissioner Nutsukin, who have been involved in earlier hearings. Paragraph 1.4 simply set out what these legal submissions will cover. What these legal submissions address is key legal issues that have been raised in the course of submissions and evidence filed by submitters. They do not address or set out the council's position on each and every rezoning, which is represented in the council planner's recommendation. Given the number and breadth of rezoning submissions being heard through the course of this hearing, it is anticipated that additional legal issues will arise that will need to be addressed in the council's reply. And I just mentioned that because the rezoning has been addressed in these opening submissions, this does not mean the council has focused more or less on that particular rezoning through this process. A critique of every submitted case has not been undertaken in these legal submissions due to the amount of resource required to address the high number of submissions. Experience in previous hearings suggests that other council may undertake a detailed critique of the council's evidence in their own legal submissions. However, the council does not have the capacity to respond in kind. In the council's submission, the evidence before the panel must be read in totality and with the context and strategic framework in which it has been prepared in mind. And we suggest the panel needs to approach with caution any cherry-picking or selective criticism of council's evidence. What we have covered or addressed in these opening submissions are a number of questions that were put to both council and submitters during the course of the Upper Clutha rezoning hearing. So I have endeavoured to front foot that in this hearing so that you have the council's position on those matters in front of you right from the start. Turning to section 2, this section and also appendix 2 has been presented to the panel in various hearings, so Mr. Chair, I do apologise for any repetition. But so the legal framework for plan review is set out in sections 31, 32 and sections 72 to 76 of the RMA. And the various matters included in those sections have been comprehensively defined by the Environment Court in the Colonial Vineyard decision, and I have set that out, the relevant extracts in Appendix 1. The panel's recommendations must consider whether the zone assists the council to carry out its functions in order to achieve the purpose of the Act and whether the zone is in accordance with Part 2 of the RMA. That comes from Section 72. So Section 5 of the Act sets out that sustainable management purpose, defines Section 5 of the RMA, involves an overall broad judgment of whether a proposal will promote sustainable management. Exercising this judgment allows for balancing of conflicting considerations in terms of their overall relative significance or proportion in the final outcome. In addition, under Section 6, identified matters of national importance and of most interest in this hearing are outstanding natural landscapes, features and also significant natural areas must be protected from inappropriate use and development.
That is correct,
so the qualification in terms of inappropriate use for division use and development doesn't apply. What is inappropriate should be assessed by what is thought to be protected and will be heavily influenced by the context. And then, of course, particular regard is to be had for the other matters listed in Section 7 of the RNA, which include efficiency, amenity, values, and ecosystems. Also, under Section 8, the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi are to be taken into account.
Just before you move on, is Section 6A relevant? In these areas, that is the natural character of lakes and rivers and protection that are inappropriate?
Yes, it is, particularly in the context of Queenstown Park Commission, where they seek the new sub-zone, which starts in the Remarkable Park Zone and crosses the river before it heads up the Garden Remarkable. So I understand that Mr. Buxton has considered the relevance of the sub-zone going over the river in that area.
Mm-hmm. Well, while we're on that, I'll also foreshadow a question on the relevance of sub-zone water conservation orders, that the water conservation order applies to the Kawerau River, the lake, and all the tributaries. And what developments we should put those overall, and I'll come back to that at the end, but I'll just raise that now so that might want to think about that. So I'm sure you'll have more intended to finish your submission.
Yes, I can. And I should just foreshadow what I've intended to do in this section is foreshadow the sort of overall approach, and there are some site-specific rezonings where additional matters are treated, and Section 6A is certainly one of them. And my apologies if this isn't quite comprehensive enough to cover the entire range. So it then becomes a question of weight as between the strategic direction chapters, higher order planning instruments, and part two of the RMA, which is a matter for the panel's discretion. It is the council's evidence that its reply version of the chapters do give effect to part two of the RNA and therefore give substance to part two of the RNA. It is also the Council's submission that no significant challenge to the Council's strategic approach was made in the earlier viewing stream in terms of the need for the Council to protect its nationally important landscapes in Section 6B, significant Indigenous vegetation and significant habitat for Indigenous fauna in Section 6C, and also to maintain its Section 7 landscapes, which is at the heart of a large portion of the rezoning submission before this panel. It has also submitted that, with regards to its urban development approach, this was not seriously challenged, except for arguably within the Motutapu Basin, which was the consequence of the panel's minutes recommending the council initiate a further landscape study on the basin. So in that context, there was a lot of planning evidence filed in strategic direction hearing, but that was the majority of the evidence that was filed for the various submissions. And it is at this level where the number of submissions have really, upped ante in terms of the sort of technical evidence that they have provided to the panel in order to justify their rezoning. At a high level at paragraph 2.7, in terms of a number of submissions before the panel, it is submitted that the submitter has provided insufficient evidence to allow the council to assess the potential effects of the zone being pursued. The submitter has not demonstrated under section 32 that their preferred zone is an appropriate method. The proposed zone or new subzone is inconsistent with part 2 of the RMA. And the proposed zone, new sub-zone promotes a level of activity and or a lack of control that would allow inappropriate subdivision use for development over the Section 7 landscape.
So is that just the Section 7 landscape or a Section 7?
Section 6.
We do typos as well.
My apologies for the couple of explanations. I'm a bit embarrassed, but anyway, that is definitely a Section 6 landscape.
Thank you.
So, the overall broad judgment approach in part 2 remains valid for your recommendation. And there's no authority that council is aware of that supports an approach where this panel need not look beyond either the strategic chapter objectives of the PDP, the regional policy statement, or a relevant national policy statement. Of course, those letters, documents must be given a speech to.
I didn't understand this paragraph because it seemed to be like an editor that I could read on. So, could you? So, for example, please?
Yes, absolutely. So, this came out of the article at the hearing. In the context of the upper court hearings, a similar type of rezoning submission, a question was asked from the panel as to whether it didn't need to go further than the strategic objectives of the proposed district plan and its recommendation. So essentially whether it could compare two zone types against the strategic objectives in chapters 3, 4, 5 and 6, and that was the end of the matter in terms of the recommendation. Unfortunately, perhaps for the panel, the submission is that there's no authority supporting that approach. And essentially, the King Salmon principle does not apply in this context. It doesn't apply because the strategic direction, there is some authority subsequent to King Salmon, which is an objective in the plan you were considering at that time is settled or established. You need to go beyond that objective and you can assume that it has a feature to part two and you do not need to go to part two. But in the regime we are working within, the strategic direction objectives are not established or settled.
Good.
And then how it works is then you then go to the next sort of step in the hierarchy, which in this context is the operative regional policy statement, which is under review at the moment. And at paragraph 2.12 of my submission, I note there that Ms. Banks' evidence has set out the relevant objectives in the regional policy statement. They are summary, not highly specific, nor are they directive, as I can see, they don't really too far in either direction. So they don't particularly travel, they don't help at all in terms of stopping there, in terms of where you go further. And of course they are under review at the moment, and the proposed regional policy statement is under appeal, and at the moment parties are still mediating, so that is still in a state of flux.
But thank you. I did read all the rest of it, but it was that particular paragraph. What's this about?
So the question is, just before we move on from 2.8, in terms of the strategic directions chapters, while they are not we must look beyond them. Presumably we can, because they're inconsistent with them. I mean, there must be an internal consistency required in the district plan, isn't there?
Yes, there must. And CAFLA's submission is that its version of the reply chapters, particularly chapters 3, 4, 5 and 6, which I go over for the discussion, give effect to part two, and the council's evidence that they do give effect to part two. So council was saying, we invite you to place a good amount of weight on the council's strategic chapters, but as a matter of law, you cannot assume that they give effect to part two, because they are still subject to submission and
yes.
Potentially appeal.
So our report would need to go back to part two.
Yes. Okay, thank you. And that is why we have, taken some effort to provide Ms. Banks strategic evidence, which does take you through the various chapters, and try and provide you with some context as to how we got to here. So essentially paragraphs 2.11 through 2.16 explain why the Tennessee presumption cannot be applied in the recommendation. I've already explained strategic objectives and also the regional policy statement. In relation to the national policy statement on food and development capacity. I'm just going to refer to it as I have set that out there because it is also a higher order document that the proposed district plan must give effect to. But in the council's submission, it is an enabling policy in that it requires the council to ensure that any one time there is sufficient housing and business land capacity. And although the policy statement doesn't fall within one of the concerning exceptions in terms of it being that is a document that is established, complete and valid, it doesn't include any environmental bottom line, as was the case with the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement. For example, it doesn't include any water policy. So what the NZ does is require the council to provide sufficient capacity, but in the council's submission, it can't determine whether a various rezoning submission should be approved or otherwise, particularly when the council's evidence is that there is sufficient realisable development capacity in the Queenstown ward to give effect to the national policy statement, and there are other resource management reasons for not rezoning the land. So where that takes you is you need to amend the information to go to council.
Presumably the reverse applies too, so that the fact that council says that there is enough capacity, but having looked at part two, we conclude that a rezoning is appropriate, that is not necessarily a problem, is it?
No. The council submission is simply that a submission cannot use the NPS as a lever to say we must rezone my land.
It can't overwhelm part two.
If you are saying that additional zoning is still over and above, if we were minded to grant some of these submissions, the fact that you've got sufficient capacity is not there.
He said that's correct. Yes, so you can go beyond the NPS in terms of how much capacity is provided in a plan, but the council's submission, my submission, is that the NPS cannot require you to rezone more. Particularly when the council
season is that they've already in terms of industrial, Mr. Osborne fortunately had this exception zone committed at a time.
Yes.
Is there comparable residential issues?
You can ask that same question to Mr. Osborne this morning, but I do recall that Mr. Osborne provided evidence in the residential hearing, and I believe Ms. Banks has quoted it in her strategic summary that addresses where essentially, I will leave this off because he's explaining how these are nice, but it talks about whether it's not simply a matter of you cannot provide too much, but he does look at where you should provide additional capacity, and he does look at that level of detail. So I do invite you to ask us what's on that kind of question. So turning to section 3, comparison of zones as methods. This is another question that came out of the proposal of rezoning hearing, and essentially it interlinks with the previous submission I've just given you in terms of how does your role in considering what is the most appropriate zone fit within the second time frame of making decisions on the proposed district plan. And so my submission is that a zone is a subzone method, and that it allocates certain provisions of the plan to a particular area of land, and that zoning should receive that particular zone and zone suggested grant policy. So in terms of the structural approach of the PDP, those particular zone and subzone objectives and policies should then in turn reflect the broader objectives and policies set out in the strategic objectives and policies located in chapters 3 to 6 of the PDP. And although this panel is generally comparing what are two or more zones and deciding on which one is most appropriate, this comparison cannot be completed in isolation from the provisions within the zones themselves. In effect, the application of a zone means that a certain set of rules will be applied to the land, vehicle jurisdiction 76 subclause 3, the council, and subsequently the panel must have regard to the actual or potential effects on the environment of any activities that would apply to the application of a rule within a rezoning request. Although it is acknowledged that there is no presumption that a notified zone is more appropriate than, a zone sought for a submission, our submitters do need to provide a level of detail analysis that corresponds to the scale and significance of the environmental effects that are anticipated from the implementation of the new zone. And then the council submission needs to provide sufficient evidence to assist the panel in considering whether actual potential adverse effects are satisfactory before it makes a recommendation that the zone is more appropriate than the notified zone.
Just on the issue of zones, it's actually, I think, came out in the 7th section of the Secretary's report. Are we restricted to choosing between zones which are in the PDP, or are we able to make up a totally new zone?
Okay, from a legal perspective, you're allowed to make up a complete new zone, provided it sits within the scope of the original submission. And
panel submissions invite invites to have a catchphrase along the lines of all any other zone, which is what we previously asked for.
Yes, and that creates scope, but it then turns to whether you've got the evidence for you to recommend a zone. I mean, there are some obvious examples where, for example, QPR and Skyline, they have proposed, you know, reasonably substantial sub-zones or zones which are not already in the CDP, and it's essential that there's some kind of phase change running through this process, which is exactly what this provides for. That fits neatly into these submissions in that when you are making and considering those particular new zones, you do need to consider whether the rules, policies, objectives are meeting the test, because they haven't been through the hearing that all of the other zone types already had. For example, we've had a 5-week hearing on the rural zone, or something like that. Absolutely, the panel is entitled to bring those types of zones or sub-zones into the PDP. Councils, its position is obviously that, well, it's clearly that there needs to be sufficient evidence to go down that track. The council, I guess, also cautions against having a number of bespoke zone types within its proposed district plan. It's not all that desirable, but that doesn't mean that you couldn't make that recommendation for this.
Well, I think the reason I asked the question is there are several instances where people have asked for a particular zone, such as the shopping centre zone, and the reason the council is not happy with it is because of, in some instances, the residential component, and in some instances, the retail component. But those aren't the only activities that can occur in that zone. And maybe I'm just foreshadowing that maybe the planner should be thinking whether there are activities that you could make a subset of, for example.
Yes, I understand your question. What the planner can also recommend is site-specific rules that sit within one of the PDP zone types.
Yes.
For example, the local shopping centre zone, as decided on by the panel in the business hearing stream, but there might be a site-specific rule that applies to a particular area of land, and there's certainly scope for this panel to be making recommendations that they sit within the plan. So turning to section 4, council's strategic approach. So as I mentioned a couple of times, Ms. Gates' strategic evidence and her summary of evidence explains how the council's approach to rezoning submissions is based firmly on the strategic approach to urban development that is set out in the strategic direction chapters 3-6 in the PDP as a whole. The strategic direction chapter provides the overarching direction for the other chapters within the plan and sets out high-level strategic objectives and policies for each of the 7 goals within the in chapter 3. This hierarchy within the plan means that the zoning and associated rules need to achieve the relevant zoning objectives and policies, which in turn needs to achieve the higher order objectives and policies as set out in the strategic direction chapter. I have included a summary of the council's strategic approach in appendix 3 of these submissions. I don't propose to take you through them because I'm going to thank through that shortly. I just wish to turn your attention to objective 3.2.1. And through that objective, council's objective is to ensure that urban development occurs in a logical manner that promotes a compact, well-designed and integrated scheme, manages cost of infrastructure and protects the district's rural landscapes from sporadic and sprawling development. So I'll leave this back to take you through the rest, but I just wish to draw your attention to that objective.
3.2.1.
3.2.2.1.
3.2.1.
And that's the reply there. Yes, it is. And all references in the council's evidence, at least otherwise stated, to the reply version of it. Finally, in paragraph 4.3, I just mentioned there that the council's planners have undertaken a weighting exercise for each submission in a thorough and careful manner, and this exercise is supported by, where relevant, council's expert evidence, which includes the likes of landscape, ecology, transport, urban design, infrastructure, as well as safety, acoustics, and commercial and industrial economics.
Urban design
evidence. I'll cover that up. Okay, so
this list has just gone up to 15. We did have urban design evidence in the strategic chapter from Mr. Bird.
Yes.
And some of it is probably relevant.
Yes.
Nonetheless, even though that was given in stream 1, since his comments are probably relevant on rezoning in part.
Yes, no, that is correct. Sorry, I just mean in terms of the which group that council is calling more than urban design. Okay, turning to outstanding actual impact infections. I refer you to the recent Court of Appeal case now on Station and Auckland Council, and it is of relevance to the panel's assessment. In that case, the Court of Appeal warned of the danger of confusing the classification process of identifying ONLs with the consequence of the ONL classification of the relevant land. The first step is to establish whether there is an ONL and then apply the relevant provision as developed through the PDP process to those areas. I won't read out the two extracts from that case, but I'll read out this one. However, the issue of whether land has attributes sufficient to maintain an outstanding landscape within the ambit of Section 6C of the Act requires an essentially factual assessment based upon the inherent quality of the landscape itself. The direction in Section 6C of the Act that first impacted under the Act must recognise and provide for the protection of LMs and ONLs from inappropriate subdivision use and development, clearly intends that such landscapes be protected. The second extract from the case, I have set that out, is this extract hints, but I don't think there's a clear decision in there no more, that it's no longer possible after the Supreme Court's judgment in King Salmon to use the overall judgment in terms of the protection to be afforded to an ONL. It hints that it doesn't make that explicit decision, so I'm not going to make that submission, but it is relevant. I guess I do come back to this in terms of, yes, you do balance the part two matters, but there comes to a point where you have to still have to protect an ONL, and there comes a point where development becomes inappropriate and you no longer the council will be no longer making decisions of the act that allows development to go even if coming out. So that's an evidential question, but there comes a point where the council says, okay, yes, there is an overall governance approach in part of the RMA, but we still need to protect our own house with an appropriate development.
So can you use an overall judgment approach to determine whether it's inappropriate or development would be appropriate or inappropriate?
My submission is that there comes a point where the development is inappropriate, but you may receive submission from our legal counsel. I haven't seen such a study in this hearing, but I
didn't have a question really is, your submission with respect to the bid value, you said there comes a point, but where is that point? And how do you know when you reach them?
That's a matter of the experts in terms of the landscape experts as to whether the development proposed under a particular zone type would be inappropriate in terms of affecting the values of the landscape that is protected. So the council's position essentially is you cannot get a whole bundle of positive effects that are unrelated, for example, to the development that's affecting the O&L. You cannot use those unrelated positive effects to balance against the effects on the O&L and say, well, okay, it still achieves the purpose of the RMA.
Just going back to Steve. Is what you're saying, that when you're dealing with those issues where submitters have sought moving the O&L boundary and rezoning, that it's a two-step process. We have to decide on the O&L boundary first before we move to considering the appropriateness of the zoning.
That is correct, it's a top-down approach.
Right.
If I can take you to paragraph 4.8. So there is a point where the type and or density of development within an O&L cannot be absorbed without impacting on the inherent quality of the landscape and therefore becomes inappropriate. It is also important to note that the outcome must achieve the relevant objectives of the PDP, including the strategic direction and landscape chapters. The next section of the submission follows on from those submissions, I guess. There are some instances within the district where Ms. Bant has identified that a landscape line is located over a zone other than the rural zone, which raises the question of whether the notified zone provides the necessary protection of the values that make the landscape outstanding. What we have here is it's been identified as an O&L, and then the question is whether the zone provisions that apply to that area of land protect the values that make it outstanding. Some of these are on the operative district plan zones, such as Pearl Rise and Licensed Park, and the panel has issued a minute to the effect that it has no jurisdiction over those zones. For the stage one PDP zone, the bank has identified that O&Ls have urban zones at Creighton, which is a medium density zone, and also at Jack's Point. For Jack's Point, evidence has been provided in the Jack's Point zone hearing stream that the Jack's Point zone objectives and policies as recommended contain sufficient protection of O&Ls from inappropriate subdivision development. In terms of the Franklin medium density zone, the medium density residential provisions, of course, enable intensive residential development, and they are not designed to cater for section 60 landscapes or section 7C landscapes, nor do they restrict development in this area and the assessment matters in chapter 21, which is the rural chapter, are not triggered under that zone type. This bank has recommended that land be rezoned to rural, with the scope of this change in zoning being the Stevens Defence position. The rural zoning is based on reduced impact on landscape values, and the landscape assessment measures set out in chapter 21 in a comprehensive way. So in terms of the those two examples where the UNL is going rural, one is assuming fixed through a position, which provides scope to going to rural. The other, the council's evidence is that the zone provisions are appropriate in terms of sufficiently protecting the outstanding values of that land. However, subsequent to filing evidence, council has identified a further issue at Arthur's Point, where the planning map indicates that there is an ONL zone low density. I understand there will be scope within the Universal Development Submission to amend either the underlying zoning or the location of the ONL. However, we have no landscape evidence that has been picked up subsequent to filing the council's evidence. So I foreshadow that this is an issue. It could be something that we could look at during the course of the hearing in terms of getting the council's landscape expert to take a look at that land, and I suggest maybe the panel might want to think about that and let me know.
So if you really ask for questions that became reasonably apparent to us that all of the Arthur's Point is an R&L according to the maps, including the rural operative rural visitor zone, there seems to be, there is some evidence, we have evidence from both Dr. Reed and Mr. Hestley in relation to the
large
mont and Gertrude Savory Lane. So we'd certainly be at scope to deal with that on the evidence. But it is perplexing that essentially a suburb is identified as being in the known now. And I wonder whether it was an error. And missed off the line, or was it purposeful? That's probably the more interesting question that I think that would be useful if the council could actually provide evidence in this hearing, probably from Dr. Reed, because my understanding of the earlier environmental decisions was that the outstanding natural landscape ended at the rural visitor zone boundary at Arthur's Point, so.
Yes, I don't have answers to you right now, otherwise it would be in writing. But it is something that we would like to look at, and if it's got within this particular hearing stream to a license, council would like to do that. The rural visitor zone that you mentioned,
It's not, but the urban growth boundary goes around the outside of the just looking at submission 177 does have a relief. I mean, the proposed district planning map says the yellow lines are only shown on land that is considered rural. So that certainly provides scope. If we had the evidence and Dr. Reed did the work there, it may well be that her work didn't suggest that conclusion about this point. But maybe it would be useful to know what her recommendation to the council was when she did that work.
Yes, and perhaps later on in the week we can ask Dr. Reed to
We'd be happy to accept that as later evidence.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of trust the problem and leave it to something that requires further work.
Thank you. think I should just add in that where some of these inconsistencies had come from historical planning decisions. For example, zoning consent, for example, that is about a certain amount of development within an RL, so there is a certain amount of pregnancy that needs to be taken. Although it would be ideal to make it 100% perfect, I'm not sure if we are quite working in that framework, but there are some which are over land that haven't been notified yet, and that will of course be considered as the council moves through notification of subsequent stages of the plan. And we will do what we can within the Parks Commission to talk about stage one. So, moving on, onto section 5, residential and business land use needs. So, the population and occupied dwelling growth projections used to feed into both the residential dwelling capacity model and the retail and commercial growth modelling were completed by Rationale. These projections represent growth projections specific to the district, factoring in the unique growth drivers. I refer you to Mr. Walter Clark's evidence. I have handed out a summary of his evidence, and he is one of the council's experts that you have advised you do not have any questions on. But his evidence sets out the projections for population increase, as I set out in paragraph 5.2. And just to explain here, his projection and his report have a, there is a 2016 start date in terms of projections, and then there is a 2018 start date in terms of projections. And just to forefront any confusion that there might be in the council's evidence, Mr. Osborne has looked at the start of 2016 as the 2017 start date, whereas Ms. Banks has looked at 2018. And therefore, there are slightly different projections, and it depends on what date you look forward from. In terms of the dwelling capacity model, that change in start point doesn't affect the differences. And what I would endeavour to do is put a footnote in their documents where and why those differences. And it is because of that start date.
Right. But presumably the end date figure remains the same.
Yes, it's 2038, 2048.
Yes.
And 2028, we're rather. So, during the course of these hearings, some memoranda have been filed in relation to the National Policy Statement. The Council and Property Economics have, in the last few months, focused on updating and refining the dwelling capacity model to the notified proposed district plan as it relates to residential dwelling capacity for the Upper Queensland, Queenstown and Waterloo areas. Also for context, on this side of the hill, in terms of the, I'm sorry, this should be the Upper Queensland, Queenstown and Waterloo areas. On this side of the hill, the two hearing streets are separated out in terms of Queenstown and Waterloo. And of course, Waterloo is going to be subject to a subsequent hearing street. But for purposes of this evidence, those two band areas have been considered as one. So important concepts referred to in evidence for the council are plan enabled capacity. This illustrates under the provisions of the PDP, notified in stage one, and otherwise the popular district plan, the opportunity available to the market. Feasible capacity, and Mr. Osborne's evidence explains that this represents what is economically feasible to develop due to market conditions and other influencing factors. For example, if the cost of the enabled capacity is recovered through the sales value and a predetermined return is achieved, then the development capacity is then feasible. And then the third concept is realisable capacity. And Mr. Osborne's evidence also explains that this estimate reflects an estimated proportion of unimplemented development and therefore takes into account a variety of differing motivations that will change in terms of what the market actually provides. And to put it simply, it's sometimes referred to as development chance.
Does this breakdown take account of landowners who don't propose to develop their land, or that might have an urban zone?
That is what is taken into account in terms of when you move from feasible to realisable capacity. So that's taken into account, for example, land banking.
To respect the value increase. I have one particular area in mind, but that's just.
So this third concept, realisable capacity, is also now encapsulated in the National Policy Statement on Human Development Capacity and Policy PC1, which requires that a council factor in the proportion of feasible development capacity that may not be developed by factoring in an additional margin of feasible development capacity over and above projected demand of at least 20% in the short and medium term and 15% in the long term. Under both Mr. Osborne's realisable capacity assessment, or through adding on an additional margin under policy PC1, there is sufficient development capacity under the council's recommendation. In terms of Mr. Osborne's realisable capacity, he does explain it, but what he essentially has done, his estimate adds on 22% in his evidence when he takes you from feasible to realisable. So that is a higher percentage and more conservative than what the MP actually requires the council to do in its premise.
I think, just looking at these two paragraphs, it seems to me the numbers were the wrong way around. That if you take 9,500, which is in paragraph A, little one, or number two, and you add 20%, you get 11,400. And if in B, you've got 15,100, and you take off 20%, you get 12,080. It seems to me that in paragraph 5.6, it's gone the wrong way around. The capacity has been, shouldn't be increased, it's actually the demand that's increased by 20%, isn't it?
Yes, well, actually, 5.6 is a correction I need to make, which I have got here. My correction is simply to delete that paragraph. Because the 27% margin shouldn't be added to realisable capacity anyway. If you were working under the NPS policy PC1, you add that to feasible capacity, so it's second step down when you're working out what is realisable capacity.
But even that's the wrong way. It's demand. If you're allowing a 20% margin, you must increase the demand rather than the capacity. Because if you're increasing the capacity, you're saying there's more available land.
Yes.
And that seems, and if the NPS has got it wrong, that's fine, if I can understand that it was. But that still doesn't mean that we should do it the wrong way.
PC1 isn't entirely fair, and
I think it's for the environment to write up, as I understand.
What it does say is that local authorities shall also provide an additional margin of feasible development capacity over and above projected demand. So it is the additional margin that it has to provide is a capacity.
Yes, but that means that the capacity, the required capacity is increased, not the available capacity.
Yes.
But I didn't read this in the submissions as actually saying that they sort of that they're providing more capacity.
Yes, if I can take you back to the submission, paragraph 5.5a, what that is setting out is the projected growing demand for the Queenstown ward. So that is essentially separate to the dwelling capacity model. So that is working out how many additional dwellings are estimated to be needed, and that is based on the Clark evidence. Whereas subparagraph B, that has come from Mr. Osborne's evidence, which is that his estimates are that there will be 15,100 dwellings of realisable capacity. So that is those submissions are given in putting to one side policy PC1.
Mm. rough. Okay. And then if we look at what probably is the intention of PC1, which is to ensure there's a 20% margin when you hit that, you take 20% off that 15,000 wages. And then it was the 12,000 I gave. So it'd still be the right numbers.
Yes, there would be, and I could ask Ms. Banks to give you that figure, but what has already been worked out, but it is over and above the projected dwelling demand of 9,500 dwellings for 2020.
Okay. Which
is what paragraph 5.7 tells you. There is also, so those studies are given at the ward level, so maintaining ward level. There is also consideration of what the capacity is within the urban environment, the urban environment as defined in the national policy statement. So in paragraph 5.10 of my submission, given a strict interpretation of policy 1 of the NPS, it requires the council to compare capacity against demand within the bounds of the urban environment only. So council's evidence within the urban environment, which generally aligns with the urban growth boundary, is that there will be sufficient reliable development capacity of 13,338 dwellings. So that's a correction in paragraph 5.10.
Can you get number again, please?
14,338.
Oh, yes.
Yes, and that comes from a fact that then put out in her appendix of the summary evidence.
I'm just looking at PR1 and in saying that it's arguable that you look at an environment, so you deriving that assumption or that arguability from the fact that PA1 talks about the land having to be suited to the zoning in service. Because it wouldn't be feasible zoned in service that it was sitting in a rural area, in a rural zone. But where did you come to that arguability?
It comes from the definition of urban environment in the National Policy Statement. I don't want to get into this in too much detail because it gets quite confusing, but the definition of urban environment and urban area in the NPS, they are different things. And they essentially mean you take a different area of the district in terms of what they are. When I use the word arguably, the reason I say that is strictly the definition of urban environment essentially limits you to urban areas. However, the council is essentially directed through this national policy statement to apply these policies across the district because it has a high growth area within it.
Yes, I was reading all of that in one reason. So it comes from the definition of urban environment and the other definition was
The definition of urban areas, which is the term used in the objective.
And it's not defined as a term, though, is it? Urban environment is defined, and then they use urban area in the word. I guess.
Yes, they do. The definition of urban areas takes you to the Statistics New Zealand definition of urban areas.
Yep, thank you.
So to summarise all of that, essentially what the council's evidence is whether you're looking within the urban growth boundary or whether you're looking at the ward as a whole, and whether you're using realisable capacity under Mr. Osborne's estimate or you apply the extra 20-15% under policy PC1, the council's position on the zones is providing sufficient capacity.
That is achieved without relying on, for example, expanding the Milwaukee or Kingston to meet that demand. That's good. So that is within the Queenstown urban growth boundary areas.
Yes.
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 And that's where they are.
Yes. So sort of whatever way you think it, council's evidence is that there is sufficient dwelling capacity. And there has been one statement of evidence filed by submitted that opposed council's CCM evidence, that's the evidence of Mr. Judy. Comments on this evidence are made in Kimberley Bank evidence summary, and it will be addressed in more thoroughly in the reply to Mr. Judy.
On that question I asked you, I said Queensland and Queensland, is that Queensland and Arrowtown or just Queensland?
That includes Arrowtown. Of course Arrowtown is within the local territory of the industry.
Yes. So I'm just trying to get a sense of the total things other than those two. But
yes, it does.
Because Lake Hayes and Shadow Country are also in, or Shadow Country isn't, but Lake Hayes is in the Waterbury industry as well. That's also in Queensland and the Great Boundaries.
Yes, and that's why Council's evidence at this hearing has considered the Wakatipu and Queenstown hearing screen geographic area just as one.
Yep.
So it's too hard to split that out. So, unless there's any more questions, I'll turn to commercial land. So NPS applies to the supply of business land as well as residential development capacity. And for the purposes of this hearing, Mr. Heath has undertaken an analysis of commercial land, retail, service and office activities needs of the district. So Mr. Heath isn't appearing to talk to the position, but I have handed up his summary of evidence, so you can read that and it's interesting about the summary of evidence. So his evaluation has involved reviewing the current supply of business zone land based on the PDP stage 1 zones as notified to date and otherwise under the operative district plan. Estimating the vacant commercial zones that is available to meet future demand and then comparing projected demand by using the property economic retail expenditure model over the 2017 to 2048 period against supply. Mr. Osborne's evidence determining office land requirements has fed into Mr. Heath's overall conclusion, which is that there is sufficient commercial land provision in the Wakatipu ward to meet projected commercial land demand requirements over the next 10 years and 20 years time frame, so that's through to 2038. In the longer term 20 to 30 year time frame, additional commercial land might be required in this ward. And it's set out in this table on page 15, which shows that within the Wakatipu ward, under Mr. Heath's estimate, in the long term, so we're talking well beyond the life of the plan, is estimated to be a shortfall of 15.1%. The council's evidence is that there is more than sufficient commercial capacity within the council's recommended version of the zones for the life of this district plan. In addition, the NPF places a higher onus on the council to monitor this issue, including every 3 years it completes a housing and business capacity assessment. The first one I understand is 2017, the height of the council. There is an additional assurance in that the council is required to review this plan 10 years after it becomes operative. And the NPF suggests that if the council's monitoring identifies that there is a capacity shortfall, it must respond within 12 months. I understand that no evidence has been provided by submitters that challenge council's evidence on commercial capacity, and as a consequence it is submitted that there is no merit in any arguments that the council needs to rezone additional business or office land in order to give effect to the NPF or to, for example, achieve the purpose of the RMA. In terms of industrial land, this is where Mr. Osborne's evidence is of relevance. So, Mr. Osborne has determined industrial land requirements and he concludes that the current industrial zone land is expected to meet the market needs to the beginning of 2030. Although neither Wakatipu nor Upper Clipper has sufficient industrial land to meet 2048 demand requirements, which is a 30-year planning period. The council is underway with a comprehensive analysis of industrial land needs for the purposes of stage two of this review. The first of the capacity assessments. I've got here
one of those, I guess, is stage two.
So the reference here to the capacity assessment is for the NZ obligation. Will also include the check that one of them. This is 2017 for a for the full housing and business development capacity under policy TV1, so that needs to be completed by end of this year. And that will include a full analysis of industrial land, which is not included in the evidence before you because industrial zones have not been notified in stage one and that work is still underway. In this hearing room, a group of submitters have proposed a congruent industrial zone of some 19 hectares near the base of the Remarkables. Mr. Osborne and his rebuttal evidence has responded to the economic evidence of Mr. Cochran for the submitter. Mr. Osborne continues to disagree with the proposed provision allowing for office activity as a restricted discretionary activity, considering that this represents an economic risk to existing commercial zones and centres.
What is the council's position that the officers were removed from that zone? You might want to take instructions.
Yes, I will need to add that legal detail. I do recall there possibly some issues with retail as well, and the provisions that have been proposed by the submitter. So if just officers are removed, I think they're still.
But the retail, yes, I mean, given that earlier I said, when we discussed further, we could look at print, removing things from the various zones, that was an example.
Yes,
and so we usually know what the council's position would be, rather than saying, is there a position that they would take unacceptable?
I suspect there is. I will liaise with Mr. Buxton before his appearance tomorrow.
Okay.
Turning to section 6, so these submissions are focused on the matters of infrastructure and transport, and the evidence that's been provided by the council is relevant to the panel's overall decision making. In relation to infrastructure, Council's position is that a rezoning request should be declined where an urban zone is sought, but no or insufficient capacity currently exists in the infrastructure network, and there is no long-term plan provision for the relevant infrastructure upgrade. There are three exceptions to this approach where the Council does not consider it to be Table 4, and this is in relation to the rural residential and rural lifestyle zones, where on-site infrastructure can be privately provided and where the zones are not anticipated to connect to the council network. And this is consistent with Mr. Bradman's evidence on the various rezoning submissions. I have said here I understand only the rural zone is an issue in this hearing stream, but I did read the evidence last night, which is a rezoning towards rural lifestyle and rural residential, so I suspect I'm incorrect. In relation to the transport network, Council holds a similar position in that a rezoning request should be declined where an urban zone is sought but no or insufficient capacity currently exists in the transport network or a key intersection for that rezoning is required, for example, if it doesn't exist or there needs to be an upgrade. The exception to this is where either Chapter 27, which is a subdivision chapter, is sufficient to address the lack of capacity or there is a site-specific rule requiring the upgrade of a road or intersection before development has occurred.
Haven't we gone in fact 27 is fine and it's a council road, haven't we gone when it's dealing with NZTA, you seem to have your own criteria for upgrades?
Yes, I do come back to state highways.
Yes,
on page. Would you like me to cover that now?
No,
you
can come back to that. That's fine.
Okay. And there are a number of examples where no or insufficient information on traffic and service infrastructure has been provided by a submitter. And in those instances, council has not been able to assess the potential effects of the future development and how any effects as opposed to the areas mitigated or remedied, which is the requirement in section 31, subclause 1C of the RMA. In relation to the NPS, the council was asked during the hearing whether it considered it could use the NPS as a determinant of free risk reject and urban zoning when either no or insufficient capacity currently exists in the infrastructure network or no long-term plan provision is made for the relevant infrastructure upgrade. That is not the council's position. So the council isn't relying on policy one as a determinant of reason to reject rezoning requests. So instead what that policy provides is that the council must ensure that it has sufficient development capacity. In the short term it is serviced, and in the medium term there is sufficient development capacity that is either serviced or the funding for the development infrastructure required to service that development capacity is identified in the long-term plan. So I just wanted to set that out at the outset, that that's not what the council is suggesting for its evidence, that the NPS isn't essentially a lever to say no to a rezoning as well, because it cannot be serviced or if there's no connection, for example, to council's trunk infrastructure. So I just wanted to be clear on that. Paragraph 6.8. I take you back to the strategic objectives and policies. Council's evidence is that they give effect to part two of the RMA and that infrastructure constraints as identified in the strategic directions chapter are a good reason for not rezoning, particularly in that land is outside the urban growth boundary. So the reasons provided in the council's evidence for strategic directions hearing supporting the introduction of an urban growth boundary into the proposed district plan. Also of relevance is council's evidence that additional urban zoning to enable urban development beyond what is recommended by the council in its reply version. Oh, sorry, that what is recommended by the council in terms of zoning is not required in order to achieve and give effect to the NPS. Subparagraphs A and B, I don't propose to take you through that, but I refer you to the broad functions of the council and then again to the objectives and policies included within the strategic chapters, which Ms. Banks will take you through, that they support the council's approach towards integrated planning in terms of protection and in terms of infrastructure. Also set out in Appendix 4, not in Appendix 3, but Appendix 4, is a more detailed analysis of recent case law, which supports the position that it would be contrary to the purpose of the Act to zone land for an activity where the necessary infrastructure to allow the activity to occur without adverse environmental effects does not exist and there is no commitment by council to provide it.
Does that also work, for instance, to other areas where they may propose their own servicing? But we have no indication that that servicing is likely to satisfy the requirements, for instance, of the regional water plan or something like that.
Yes, it does. Council has. Was not council's evidence, but there's some evidence from submissions, that do address the relevance of some regional rules and requirements, particularly at Jack's point, if I recall. The council's evidence is focused on the infrastructure at a district level in terms of the council's obligations and hasn't been looked into what the regional council would be needing in terms of consent, etc. But I do recall some of the evidence to be mentioned in that territory. At paragraph 16, a problem statement that is read, but essentially what I'm speaking out there is the relevance of the long-term plan, because it is referred to and given some weight in this business evidence. So again, in terms of the UK law, which is set out in Appendix 4, it's permitted to apply equally to transport. In paragraph 21 of the four-wheel case, which is flagged in Appendix 4, is of particular relevance. And the Environment Court confirmed in that case and set out its reasons that a rezoning was creating unmeasurable expectations, and the council was being put under pressure to spend money that it had decided to commit elsewhere, and that was directly relevant to then Transit's concerns about the potential for unintegrated development to face State Highway 2 under capacity and excess pressure. And the Environment Court confirmed this was a valid concern. I know that because that is a concern that the council holds for a number of rezoning commissions. And in terms of other concerns that Ms. Wendy Banks and Mr. Nanda set out in their evidence in response to various submissions, those concerns cover the likes of safety of road users and pedestrians, the efficiency of the transport network, and the lack of capacity to deal with additional zoning, traffic effects associated with new zoning, and associated state highway accesses required to service new zoning. And finally, a lack of information or evidence provided in order to properly assess the effect on the transport network. Paragraph 6.15, I refer to Mr. Carr's evidence. I thought it was worthwhile pointing out that there are other transport experts who are aligned to the council's position in terms of concerns about accesses to the state highway, increased use of existing accesses, and ensuring a safe and efficient highway network, particularly where the where Mr. Carr considers that there isn't sufficient level of information or evidence to suggest to have that effect. And Mr. Chair, at paragraph 6.16, this relates to the state highway, and it will be a question. So a number of rezoning submissions would require access onto parts of State Highway 6 in the Franklin Flats and Jacks Point areas. So legal submissions have been filed by the NZ Transport Agency that explain a separate process for considering new accesses directly onto the State Highway, where it's a limited access road. Under Section 91 of the Government's Road and Powers Act, the agency's authorisation must be obtained before a new access onto a limited access road can be constructed. In relation to any new accesses, under that legislation, the agency needs to be satisfied that additional accesses are necessary and are designed in a way that promotes the safe and efficient functioning of the state highway network before it would be in a position to authorise additional accesses. In addition to that requirement, which sits outside the RMA and sits outside the district plan, the council has agreed to include advice notes in the proposed district plan text that refers to the requirement to consult with and or obtain authorisation from the agency. In addition to this process outside the district plan, it is still preferable from the council's perspective, and we do understand from the agency's perspective, that the proposed plan include clear rules regulating access directly onto state highways, and that zoning takes into account both current and planned future state highway operations.
Don't those, those rules create a conflict with NZTA or a potential conflict where you've got rules, say a structure plan approach that says there will be an access here, but NZTA can come along and say no way. Is there any point in is there any point in including rules that anticipate accesses at transit may or may not approve?
The rules that and the rezonings that council is recommending to support, they're only doing that where the agency has
already
That it's okay with those change in zonings as well.
Yes, but the council would not be putting forward anything the NZTA was still unsure about.
Yes, that's my understanding. Mm-hmm.
Mine was a small question about the use of the bus ramps in the plane. Does this happen often in this plane? I mean, is it in the...
Sometimes it's infrequently.
Because I mean, it seems to me not a good bus, and I think you're saying that by saying it's frequently rules, but...
Yes, and the bus not got no legal status, and it's essentially to assist a plane user to remind them or advise them that there is this, that is a separate legislation that they need to consider.
Is this every the same? There was a section of advice notes that covers those sorts of matters, information purposes, and so it is used extensively in the plan in that sense.
Mm.
Although some of those are a few rules as well, just to make it more interesting.
I'm not sure we're going to have that debate today, but they have been addressed through the evidence filed in the earlier hearing stream. Yes, they are used through the plan, no, they don't have legal status, and they are really there just to assist the plan user. There's just one additional matter there at paragraph 6.18. Through summary zoning submissions, the council is recommending that a six on the state highway be a matter for assessment, so control of discretion. Dependent on the activity status, and there, for example, in the case of Conjure and Industrial Zone, the council's recommendation on the sort of jet, but if it was to go through, it would recommend that effects on the state highway be a matter of discretion and your control. The same for Gibson. Subzone, the Queenstown Park Special Zone, and also a lot mini. And as we have already covered, I think this morning the council also accepts that there are some instances where site-specific rules are appropriate. That, for example, provide that development will not occur until a certain upgrade or work has taken place. And that is something that came up in the other Kuta hearing stream, where there was, for example, a rezoning submission, and there was one, there needed to be some upgrades to the council's infrastructure before there would be capacity, and that upgrade was foreshadowed in the long-term plan, but until that upgrade actually happened, that the land wouldn't be able to be serviced, and the council has recommended and put in a specific rule in certain situations. Carrying on, paragraph 6.19, relevance of the Housing Infrastructure Fund. This matter isn't covered in the Council's evidence because the announcement by the government and the subsequent to that, but I just wanted to clarify to the panel the relevance of that announcement. So the government's confirmed that 3 out of 4 Housing and Infrastructure Fund bid proposals submitted by the Council have progressed to the next phase of the fund approval process, so that's the detailed business case phase. This could mean the council will be able to draw on up to $50 million to help finance key infrastructure to enable 2 new greenfield sites, and these are at Lady's Mile and Clyde Rise South.
Can you call it Franklin Flats North? It's very confusing, isn't it? It's not Ladies Mile, and it's probably south of Clara Rise, isn't it?
No, and I was about to explain that. It's confusing with the evidence. I have to look frankly, that's not, I don't think anyone refers to that yet, but we can use that terminology.
Mm-hmm.
And also an extension to the Kingston Township. So this fund is $1 billion interest-free for 10 years, loan facility available to high-growth councils to help fund infrastructure associated with enabling residential development. The key purpose of the fund is to address short to medium-term constraints for financial and front infrastructure needed to promote residential development. The area covered by the Franklin Flats North area, which is under the fund called Photo Raster. Obviously we've got some overlaps and areas here, but the next issue is that the government's announcement of potential future funding does not guarantee development in the specified areas, but opens up the possibility of a 10-year interest-free loan facility being available to provide infrastructure to enable housing development, which can be recouped through development contributions. So there's a number of steps the council still needs to work to before the upgrades to the infrastructure in those areas could take place under the funding that's been announced. So council's position is that at this point in time, little weight should be placed on the fund announcement in terms of this mapping hearing, and the council still needs to undertake a considerable amount of work to determine whether it will move forward with the fund, and there are no guarantees that this opportunity will be taken up. I do mention, however, that the implications are consistent with the council's strategic urban development approach of promoting a compact, well-designed and integrated form, managing the cost of infrastructure and protecting the district's rural landscape from further sprawling development.
Just on that point, if the council is promoting a road improvement, it must have a purpose. Should we not take into account that, or is it the council position that it's not promoting a road improvement?
In terms of the housing and infrastructure fund, this is just about the funding at the moment for infrastructure upgrades in that area.
So if we were to accept Ms. Banks' recommendation and go to rural, then nothing would happen. Is that correct?
Not much
we're
talking about the same area as
that. Yes, we are talking about the same area as
that. Yes, so council's recommendations are essentially a mixture of rural within the out of control boundaries, rural within the outstanding natural landscape, and medium
uses. The rural in between is Ms. Banks' recommendation. Ms. Banks recommends that all of it be rural to the west of the Hawthorn Drive roundabout, and that it be high-density residential for an area east of the Hawthorn Drive roundabout. Now, the rolling fund application relates to the area west of the Hawthorn Drive roundabout, not to where the high-density is proposed. So what we are confused about is there seems to be two conflicting messages from the council on that area of land. So what I'm asking is, if we were to accept Ms. Banks' recommendation, can we presume that road will not proceed?
I don't think you can presume that, but for the purposes of this hearing, council's submission is that little weight can be placed on the proposal that was given to the government in terms of this funding, because it needs to go to the next step in terms of a detailed business case. I think that will include the more detail in terms of the location of that road.
But clearly, if we were to take all of the recommendations the council has made in that area, which includes the recommendations along Kingston Road, there would be nothing to service. So the business case would not stack up. So isn't that the outcome of accepting that position?
Well, with the council, then have to do a little re-evaluation.
Yes, I think the recommendations are based on the evidence that you have before it, and this fund is for something in the future. The council's submission is that little weight can be placed on it at this point in time. The council is going to have to maybe align the two processes moving forward, but at this point in time, the evidence before you sets out what the council's position is on the roaming set up in that area and the Banks' recommendation.
Can I just
We've got plenty of questions from the States on that, so I think we'll get to that as well. Did you have any further questions on that point? And that case will take more than a year.
Thank you.
And we'll return to you.